When Scarlett Johansson started playing Natasha Romanoff, also known as the merciless fighter Black Widow, she was the only female Avenger. But despite appearing in a number of Marvel Cinematic Universe films, Black Widow never got her own movie.
That changes with the release of Black Widow, which looks back on a previously unexplored part of the character's history. I'm Glenn Weldon.
And I'm Linda Holmes. And today we're talking about Black Widow on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Here with me and Glenn from his home in Virginia Beach is Vincent Schilling. He's an associate editor at Indian Country Today. Welcome back to the show, Vincent.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
And also joining us from his home in Washington, D.C. is critic Chris Klimek. That's a tongue twister. Hi, Chris.
I'm like Natasha Romanoff, Linda. I got a lot of red in my ledger. I'm trying to wipe the slate clean. Hello.
Outstanding. I'm here to help. So this film is directed by Kate Shortland, who comes from the independent film world. Florence Pugh stars alongside Johansson as Yelena, who was Natasha's sister in the kind of spy family in which she spent some time as a kid. Also showing up in the film are David Harbour and Rachel Weisz as Alexei and Melina, who were the father and mother figures in that family unit. The story takes place right after the events of Captain America: Civil War. So this is while the Avengers are scattered, Natasha's in hiding. She encounters Yelena, who she hasn't seen in years, and the two of them set out to defeat the Red Room, which is the brutal system in which they were both trained, which is still turning out young women who are used as assassins. The movie was delayed from last summer to this one, and it's in theaters and available to rent on Disney Plus starting today. And just one more note before we start. Obviously, this film builds in some ways on the events of the Marvel Cinematic Universe so far. So if you're not caught up over the last couple years, consider this fair warning that you may find some things out. Now, Glenn, I want to start with you. You have long been my go-to on comics. Tell me how you felt about this movie.
I mean, it depends on what you're coming to it for, right? If you're coming to it for summertime superhero action, B+ delivers on that. But if you are invested enough in the MCU to come to this film thinking, hoping that this is the one where Natasha Romanoff's character finally gets her due, my grade is, it's incomplete. It's NA. I mean, Johansson gave a really interesting interview to Collider about how the character has evolved over the years. And she's got a point, but only up to a point. Because, of course, in Iron Man 2, she was introduced as the sexual object who can kick butt. And that was pretty much the extent of her character. And then in Age of Ultron, she's someone who sees herself as a monster because she's sterile. And her main purpose in that film is to calm down the Hulk with her feminine wiles.
Yeah.
And then finally in Endgame, the culmination of the character's arc, she sacrifices herself because it comes down to a choice between a man who has a family and herself, a woman who doesn't. I don't know what I'd call that, but it's barely an arc and much less an evolution. So that's what this film is trying to do, right? This film exists as a mulligan, a kind of do-over, a retcon, as we say.
Yeah.
Here is all the inner life we didn't give her for the past 10 years because she existed in us, the producers' minds, as, you know, a character who may or may not be a romantic partner for Clint Barton or Bruce Banner or Steve Rogers. When this film goes right is that it really does try to lay some track to help establish Natasha as a character who can exist on her own. It dispenses with that pretty soon because it wants to replace her quasi-romantic relationships of the past films with a quasi-familial ones in this film. I am not sure at the end of the day that the superhero blockbuster is outfitted to accommodate all the work that's necessary to save this character from the casual dismissal she's endured for 10 years. It's attempting to course correct for her being treated as a narrative afterthought. But what's fascinating to me is what it accomplishes instead. It doesn't accomplish that. What it accomplishes instead is it creates an entirely new female character, Florence Pugh's Yelena, you mentioned, who is dealing with the same damage, but the script is much more generous to her. It allows her a lot more room, a chance to be more comfortable in her skin, more fun, more soulful, more layered. She's vulnerable without being weak. And I don't think any of that's Johansson's fault necessarily, because she's certainly capable of giving really layered performances. So I really like the casting of this film. I like the action of this film.
Mm-hmm.
And I also love the family dynamics, which are, you know, the best part of the film. But on a character level for Natasha Romanoff, I just don't think this didn't do the work that it clearly desperately wanted to do.
Yeah. Vincent, I know you really liked this movie a lot. Do you disagree about the character stuff, or did you not mind the character stuff?
No, I think Glenn brought up some pretty substantial points, and I agree. I loved the film, but I loved it with a burning ache of sadness.
Yeah.
And like I said in my review, it was like watching a movie of the best birthday party you've ever been to, but the birthday boy is dead.
Oh, boy.
That's how I felt. It's like, yeah. I agree with some critics out there that said it felt like an apology. Mm-hmm. And the biggest question I have about this is, you know, if it takes place after Civil War, then why didn't we see it after Civil War?
Yeah. I agree with you, and I think, well, let me ask Chris. What'd you think, Chris?
Linda, there are movie blockbuster franchises that purport loudly to be about family, and then those that actually are. And I think this one actually is. I think this one has a much more generous star in terms of sharing the screen, in terms of sharing the workload of the story than perhaps the star of that other franchise does. Yeah, I'm on board with the criticism that this movie should have come out in 2017. The fact that we get Ant-Man 2 3 years before we get Black Widow 1, even discounting for the pandemic, there's just no excuse for that. That's terrible, mm-hmm. right? But I do love the core four performances here, Harbour, Vice, Florence Pugh especially. And ScarJo really, really worked for me enough that I did not really notice that ScarJo herself was underserved. I mean, if this movie is disappointing to me on any level, and it kind of is, it's that these movies have become as uniform in their shape, in their running time, in their structure as the monthly comics that I started buying in the 80s from Marvel War, where they were all 22 pages long and cost 75 cents. And, you know, they don't have to be like this. You know, Black Widow's movie does not have to be of the same shape and scale as Thor's movie. And I mean, I'm not saying that the woman's movie should be any less well-funded or promoted or any of that, but I'm saying it's a different character. She has different abilities. And I would like it if the movie were even more espionage themed and didn't end with an aerial battle trying to destroy the Death Star again, basically. I actually went back last night to Avengers 2012, aka Marvel's The Avengers, aka Avengers Assemble, whatever. And watch the scene where Black Widow tricks Loki into revealing his plan. It's about halfway through the movie. You know, she sort of winds him up. He calls her an epithet, an archaic epithet that I did not remember was in the movie and was shocked to find that you could say in a PG-13 rated film. But she pretends to cry. And then Loki slips up and tells her something. And that's her ability.
Yeah.
She's really smart. She knows he's arrogant. She knows he thinks he's smarter than her. And that's her contribution to the team. She's the smartest one. And if the movie had found a way for her to showcase that rather than just being, you know, another, you know, multi-skilled, you know, martial arts super spy type, I think I would have liked it even more. But I didn't love it, but I did like it.
Yeah, I think my issue with this movie is, you know, it is literally an afterthought in the sense that they did not think of it until after. It's pretty obvious. You know, if it had always been the intent to do this, I don't think they would have waited so long. And I think because they killed her in Endgame, and I kind of agree with Glenn about the taste that that death left, particularly because it was somewhat minimized relative to the death of Tony Stark in terms of how the other characters reacted to it. Mm-hmm. I think that by the time they got to making this, they had drawn a very small circle in which they could make it, which was, where can you put this and how much can happen in it? And truthfully, when you say we're going to make a whole movie about this character, which happens before several other movies in which you've seen her, but there cannot be anything in those movies that would naturally reflect this having happened, you are drawing a very small circle in which to place this movie. Given those restrictions, it's probably a pretty good film. I agree absolutely with Chris. You know, they make these films that have like different feels. They, you know, when they made Winter Soldier and it was the kind of the paranoid thriller.
Yeah, the parallax view vibe.
Exactly. They make them with these different kind of tones. This one has kind of that funny family comedy kind of misfit tone. But then they all end with the same final act, which is some epic battle that's shot similarly, toned similarly, looks somewhat similar. And it doesn't feel natural to me. I want to bring up one other thing. And look, I really think David Harbour is good. I think he's funny. I think he's doing in this movie what they told him to do. Yeah. But to me, it's a one-note joke. And the one note is essentially the fat Thor joke. Because when Natasha finds him, runs into him again, it's many years after she knew him when she was a kid. When she was a kid, he seemed like kind of a slick spy dude. When she meets him in middle age, he's now a pudgy guy that they love to kind of make fun of how his clothes fit or don't fit. He's kind of ridiculous. He's kind of a buffoon. To me, it's the fat Thor joke. Am I wrong?
Well, he's Mr. Incredible, right? Isn't that Mr. Incredible after he's retired from being a superhero? And the reason this joke works for me a little better than it does for you, I guess, is that he's dining out on all these made-up battles with Captain America. I love that. And I mean, that scene kind of goes by where he's still in prison, where one of the other Russian inmates says to him, wait, wasn't Steve Rogers frozen in ice all this time that you're saying you fought him all these great battles? And I like that. Like, I wish the movie had emphasized that a little more, because that to me is a funnier joke than just, oh, he's fat.
Yeah.
It reminded me of one of those commercials, you know, those infomercials where no matter what the housewife does, she's like brilliantly pulls off everything, spinning 100 plates, but the husband's like getting strangled in the drapes or something because he's so inept, you know, that
right.
he just,
right.
the,
yeah.
that's kind of what it reminded. But you know what? Bottom line, it's funny. Yeah. And it was yeah. funny, as much as the jokes may be corny.
I don't know.
I definitely see your point, Linda, that the joke is one note, but they do give him something to pivot off of, right? So I think that David Harbour's casting as this bluff, overbearing Red Guardian is, you know, you talk about inspired casting. I would call this inevitable casting. There's a crucial moment early on where he says goodbye to the kids who were playing his daughter in this fake spy family, his wife on an airstrip in Cuba, and it's all very somber. And then he turns right around and greets his boss with this kind of chest-pounding glee. And at first I thought, this is a acting mistake. This is, I don't buy this guy. And then I realize that's what they're setting up, that he is that guy, the chest-pounding glee bluff guy, and not the caring father figure. So that worked
yeah.
for me. I do think that Pew is bringing a lot of real little sister energy. I think that's fun.
To me, it was a throwback to kind of, even though this movie is set only a few years ago, it feels like mm-hmm. an 80s and 90s movie where everyone has a silly Russian accent. Like
yeah.
you keep expecting people to say these evil things. It felt like that to me, but I think Pew has she has a way of dropping her voice into this lower mm-hmm. register when she does some of these kind of corny lines that really worked for me. She is the part of this that really worked really, really well for me.
Yeah, she's outstanding. Like, I want her movie immediately.
Well, we know something's coming. But like when she first starts saying, what is this? What is this? When she's like drops and making fun of you know, Black Widow's stances, flipping of the hair back, you mm-hmm. know, that was pretty hilarious.
Yeah.
Also, I just want to say, as an action star, as someone who has not really been sold that way or promoted herself that way yet, Florence Pugh runs really well. That for me is the number one test that would be action stars fail. and she's a great runner. She looks so good running. Her form
yeah.
is excellent.
I mean, I love her in this, but I just feel like there's something about this that is so, it is so confined. It just feels so hemmed in because they had so few choices. And it's one of those things where it's like, you can't throw in at the end, we are going to broaden our view.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you throw it in at the end, and this is kind of an extreme example, right? But I think it exists even in situations where it's not, you haven't chronologically hemmed yourself in so much. But when you build a world that is not terribly inclusive, and then you come back later and you're like, now I want to try to wipe it up without changing too much about it.
Yeah.
I guess I would just say when a thing is an afterthought, you can usually tell it's an afterthought. And this just screamed afterthought
yeah.
to me, even though I think director did a good job. Johansson did a good job. Pew mm-hmm. is great. I got nothing against Harbour and Vice, although I think, you know, like I said, it's not my favorite dynamic. How creative can you be?
Yeah. One last thing about the choices this film makes. I it's impossible for me to tell how much of my impression of this film was colored by the title sequence, the soundtrack of which starts with this plaintive, dolorous Russian soprano wailing on the soundtrack, segueing into children screaming in terror, which goes right into a slowed down emo cover of Smells Like Teen Spirit. And it's like, could you pick one? Just pick one. It's like putting a hat on a hat, a babushka on a babushka. I don't know, but it's like, we got to stop. We got to stop with the slowed down cover of pop songs. We got to stop. Right. The Social Network was great. It did its thing. It was a long time ago. No more moratorium. Stop it.
I attempted to make a Twitter joke about one of those dirge pop song versions, and it turned out there already was a dirge version of that pop song. So that's where we basically are. Well, tell us what you think about Black Widow. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it will be time to talk about what's making us happy this week. So come right back.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. With no fees or minimums on checking and savings accounts, banking with Capital One is the easiest decision. Kind of like Taylor Swift choosing a cardigan on a chilly day. And with their top-rated app, you can deposit checks and transfer money anytime, anywhere, making Capital One an even easier decision. That's banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Capital One N.A., member FDIC.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What's making us happy this week? Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Hot White Heist is a 6-episode scripted comedy podcast from Audible. It was created and written by friend of the show, Adam Goldman, whom we had on a long time ago to talk about his web series, The Outs. Hot White Heist is about this cabal of lesbians who convince a gay man, voiced by the great and good Bowen Yang, to put together a team to steal from a top secret maximum security cache of presidential sperm stored underneath the Space Needle for some reason. The voice cast is just queer comedy royalty. You got your Yang, you got your Jane Lynch, Cynthia Nixon, Margaret Cho, MJ Rodriguez, Cheyenne Jackson, Bianca Del Rio, Abby Jacobson, Katya Peppermint. The list goes on and on. It's directed, not for nothing, by Alan Cumming. But what I was most surprised by, pleasantly surprised by, was how richly sound designed this thing is. There are moments like there's this heist aboard a moving train where the suspense and a lot of the humor come from just how completely it places you in its world. So I can't recommend it enough. It's Hot White Heist from Audible.
All right. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Vincent Schilling, what is making you happy this week?
You know, I'll tell you one thing that I meant to get to it earlier. I finally was able to see it this week. Nobody, with Bob Odenkirk and his father, Christopher Lloyd, in the movie. And it is just an absolute riot. Hilarious. In some places, Christopher Lloyd steals the show. Nobody's just a spectacular movie I just saw recently on Amazon Prime.
All right. Thank you very much, Chris Klimek. Now, Chris, I want to start with something that you and I both wanted to acknowledge, which is the recent passing of Richard Donner, who, as it happens, we're talking about a superhero movie. He directed perhaps the granddaddy of superhero movies, which is the Christopher Reeve Superman.
Yeah, and I you know, I'm stopping myself from referring to him as Dick Donner, which is what his friends called him. But like, I have listened to so many commentary tracks and watched so many behind the scenes featurettes featuring this man that I feel like I knew him. I would recommend listeners seek out a post on Slate by Matthew Desim this week, looking into Donner's early television work. I had no idea how much TV he did, much of which is now unavailable. But that all precedes a future career that gets going with The Omen and then Superman, and then him famously getting fired off of Superman 2 and Richard Lester coming in. He goes on to make all the Lethal Weapon movies, the Goonies, films that remain beloved decades later. He was 91 years old. He had a 50-year career. And of course, Superman remains a landmark. That balcony scene, the interview between Lois and Superman, has never been surpassed in my view, nor has the John Williams score. How many subsequent superhero movies have failed to give us a piece of music as uplifting and memorable as that? The answer is a lot.
And I want to mention too that TV career that you talked about included the William Shatner Twilight Zone, where he's on the plane and he sees the funny furry costume guy on the wing.
Oh, right.
R.I.P. sir, Richard Donner, a fine director. All right, Chris, what is making you happy this week?
Yes. All right. So what's making me happy this week, Linda, is that this week happens to fall in the month of July. And the month of July on the Criterion Channel is Neo-Noir month.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, so among the movies featured on the Criterion Channel this month that I love and can recite line by line and will nevertheless most likely watch again, Chinatown, Manhunter, Blood Simple, Body Heat. In the movies I have seen but shall certainly be taking this opportunity to reacquaint myself with, The American Friend, The Eyes of Laura Mars, Night Moves, The Killing of a Chinese Bookie, The Last Seduction, and Brick, Whatever happened to that Rian Johnson guy? He seemed talented. You know, I thought he was going places.
He sure did.
July on the Criterion Channel is neo-noir month. It is making me cynical, frisky, paranoid, jealous, despondent, all the noir emotions. But I guess you could say it's making me happy.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Chris Klimek. I had an embarrassment of possibilities this week. Alex Jung's profile of Jennifer Coolidge in Vulture, John Moe's episode of Depression Mode with Joel Kim Booster, which is sad but really wonderful. But I decided to go with the new season of the TCM, that's Turner Classic Movies podcast, The Plot Thickens. Now, I have spoken on this show before about my deep, deep love of the book The Devil's Candy by Julie Salomon, who was on set and given tremendous access to the shooting of the Bonfire of the Vanities, which was Tom Hanks and Bruce Willis and Melanie Griffith, based on this Tom Wolfe book. Everybody thought it was going to be this gigantically successful mega movie. It was a huge flop. She was given so much access that I think it's why there aren't many books like this, is that she did such an amazing job of putting together the story of this. They let her in on meetings about budget and schedule and people being mad at each other. It is such an incredibly wonderful, juicy book. And she is now narrating this podcast season, which is telling this story. So it is the second season of the TCM podcast, The Plot Thickens. It is essentially the podcast retelling of the book, The Devil's Candy. You should read the book. You should listen to the podcast. She's using a lot of her old interview tapes. So they're not like great quality because they're just journalist notes tapes, but it's Brian De Palma talking. It's all these other people talking. You hear the sounds of the set when she was on it. Crazily good. You must listen to it. I'm so excited about it. And that is absolutely what's making me happy this week. If you want links for what we recommended, plus some more recommendations, subscribe to our newsletter at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. One last thing before we go, we are going to be talking about the TV series Happy Endings, and we want your questions. Send us a voice memo with your question to pchh@npr.org. Again, email us a voice memo with your question to pchh@npr.org. That brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Linda Holmes. You can find Glenn at G.H. Weldon. You can find Vincent at Vince Schilling and Chris at CT Klimek. You can find our editor, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. Producer Candace Lim is at The Candace Lim. Producer Jared Gare is at Jared M. Gare. You can find our producer, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides the music you are bobbing your head to right now. Thanks to you all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. We will see you all next week when we will be talking about Netflix's sketch comedy series, I Think You Should Leave.
Comedian Tiffany Haddish is busy. She's acting, producing, but she says she's not just doing it for herself.
How much generational wealth are you creating when you get to tell a story and give other people opportunity to tell that story with you?
Tiffany Haddish on her power in Hollywood. Listen now to the It's Been a Minute podcast from NPR.